Chapter 27. The next few days it snowed uninterruptedly. Pat was feverish and had to stay in bed. Most of the patients had temperatures. "It's the weather," said Antonio. "The fern. Too warm. Regular fever weather."
"Go out for a while, darling," said Pat. "Can you ski?"
"No. How should I be able to? I was never in the mountains before."
"Antonio will show you. It will be fun for him, and he likes you."
"I'd much rather stay here." She sat up in bed. The nightgown slipped from her shoulders. Damned thin they were. Damned thin, too, the back of the neck.
"Do for my sake, Robbie. I don't like you sitting here by the sick bed. Yesterday and the day before, that's already more than enough."
"But I like sitting here," I replied. "Haven't the least desire to go out into the snow." She was breathing loudly, and I could hear the irregular rasping.
"I've had more experience of this than you," said she, propping herself on her elbows. "It's better for both of us. You'll see, after."
She tried hard to smile.
"This afternoon and tonight you can sit here all you want. In the morning it makes me restless, darling. One looks so dreadful in the morning when one's feverish. At night it's different. I know it's superficial and silly, but I don't want to look a fright when you see me."
"But Pat..." I stood up. "All right, then. I'll go out a bit with Antonio. Then I'll be back here again at midday. Let's hope I don't break every bone with these ski things."
"You'll soon learn it, darling."
Her face lost its anxious look.
"You'll soon ski wonderfully."
"And you'll soon have me out of here wonderfully, eh?" said I, kissing her. Her hands were moist and hot, and her lips dry and cracked. Antonio lived on the second floor. He lent me a pair of boots, and they fitted well, for we were much of a size. We went to the nursery slope, which lay some way beyond the village. Antonio eyed me as we walked along. "Fever makes you restless," said he. "Queer things happen here sometimes on days like this." He laid the skis down in front of him and fastened them on. "The worst part is the waiting and not being able to do anything. It drives you crazy and does you in." "The healthy ones, too," said I, "to have to stand by and be unable to do anything." He nodded. "A good few of us work," he went on. "Some read whole libraries, but the majority turn into school children again. They play truant from their rest cure, as they used to from the gym lesson, and fly, giggling in alarm, into pantries and cupboards if a doctor happens along. Secret smoking, drinking on the quiet, forbidden midnight parties, gossip, silly practical jokes. Just to escape the emptiness. And the truth. A pretense. A frivolous and perhaps even heroic ignoring of death. After all, what else is left for them?" Yes, thought I. After all, what is left for all of us?
"Should we have a try?"
asked Antonio, propping his ski poles in the snow.
"Yes."
He showed me how to fasten the skis and how to keep my balance. It wasn't difficult. I fell fairly often, but gradually I got accustomed and could do it a bit. After an hour, we stopped. "Enough," remarked Antonio. "As it is, you'll know tonight where your muscles are." I loosed the skis and felt the blood streaming through my veins. "It was good to come out, Antonio," said I. He nodded. "We might do it every morning. It takes your mind off things." "Should we have a drink somewhere?" I asked. "We could. A Dubonnet at Forster's." We drank the Dubonnet and went back to the sanatorium. At the office, the secretary told me the postman had been asking for me. He had left a message I should go to the post office. There was some money for me there. I looked at my watch. There was still time, and I went back.
At the post office, they paid over to me 2,000 marks. There was a letter from Custer as well. I was not to worry. There was more if I wanted. I had only to write. I stared at the notes. Wherever did he get it? And so quickly. I knew our resources. And suddenly it dawned on me. I saw Bolvis again, the racing manufacturer of ready-to-wear dresses, that evening at the bar when he lost his bet, tapping covetously around Carl and saying, "I'm a buyer for the car any time." Yes, damn it. Custer had sold Carl. Hence the money so promptly. Carl, of whom he had said he would sooner lose a hand than the car. Carl was gone. He was now in the fat hands of the dressmaker, and Otto, whose ear knew him miles off, would now be hearing him howling through the streets like an outcast dog. I pocketed Custer's letter and the little packet with the morphia files. At a loss what to do, I still stood at the guichet. I should have liked to send the money back, but it couldn't be done. We needed it. I smoothed out the notes and put them away. Then I went. Damn. From now on, I would have to make a wide detour round every motor car. Cars are friends, but Carl had been more than that to us. He had been a comrade. Carl, the road spook. We belonged together. Carl and Custer. Carl and Lentz. Carl and Pat. Angry and helpless, I stamped the snow from my feet. Carl was gone. And Pat? With blinded eyes, I stared at the sky. This gray, endless sky of a crazy god who had made life and death for his amusement. In the afternoon, the wind turned. It became clearer and colder, and by night, Pat was better. Next morning, she was able to get up, and some days later, when Roth, the chap who was cured, went away, she was even able to go down to the station. A whole swarm accompanied Roth. That was the custom here whenever anyone left. Roth himself wasn't especially cheerful. He had had bad luck in his way. 2 years before, a specialist, answering his question how long he still had to live, had said 2 years at the outside, provided he looked after himself carefully. To make quite sure, he then asked a second doctor. This one gave him even less. Roth thereupon realized all his resources, divided them into 2 years, and lit out for all he was worth, without troubling any more about his illness. Finally, with a bad hemorrhage, he landed in the sanatorium, and here, instead of dying, he began steadily to get better. When he arrived, he had weighed 90 pounds. Now he weighed 150 and was in such good shape he was able to go out again. But his money was gone. "What'll I do, though?" he asked me, scratching his ginger head. "You've just come up, haven't you? How is it down there, then?" "It's changed a lot," I replied, contemplating his round, chubby face with its colorless eyelashes. He had got well again, though he had been given up. For the rest, he did not interest me. "I'll have to find myself a job," said he. "What are the chances that way?" I gave a shrug. What use was it my telling him he probably wouldn't find one? He'd discover that for himself soon enough. "Have you connections, friends, or anything?" I asked. "Friends? Well, you know." He laughed scornfully. "When you suddenly have no more money, they hop away like fleas off a dead man." "Then it'll be difficult." He puckered his forehead. "Just can't picture it, you know. I've only got a few hundred marks left, and I never learned anything but handing out money. Looks as if my old quack was right when he said I'd kick inside 2 years, though in another way, perhaps, by a bullet." I was suddenly seized with an insane fury against this blathering idiot. Didn't he realize then what life is? I saw Antonio walking ahead of me with Pat.
saw their shoulders and the back of their necks, grown thin in the grip of the disease. I knew how much they wanted to live, and I could have murdered Roth at that moment without turning a hair, if Pat might thereby have been made well again. The train pulled out. Roth was waving his hat. Those left behind called after him all kinds of things, laughing. One girl ran tottering a short way after the train, calling in a cracked, thin voice, "Au revoir! Au revoir!" Then she came back and burst into tears. The others made wry faces. "Hello," called Antonio. "Anyone crying on the station must pay a forfeit. An old sanatorium rule. A forfeit to the funds for the next party." With a large gesture, he held out his hand. The others were laughing again. Even the girl, the tears still trickling down her poor, pinched face, smiled and took a shabby purse from her coat pocket. It made me miserable. These faces around, it wasn't a laugh at all. It was a convulsive, tortured jollity. Not smiles, but grimaces. "Come on," said I to Pat, taking her firmly by the arm. We walked in silence down the village street. At the nearest shop, I went in and bought a bag of sweetmeats. "Roasted almonds," said I, offering her the packet. "You like them, don't you?"
"Robbie," said she.
Her lips quivered. "One moment," I replied, and went swiftly into the florist's alongside. Moderately calm again, I came back with my roses.
"Robbie," said Pat.
I grinned lugubriously. "Turning into a cavalier in my old age, Pat." I don't know what had come over us suddenly. Apparently it was that damned train going away. It was like a leaden shadow, a gray wind that blew down everything we most wanted still to stand. We were two runaway children, hardly knowing in from out, but anxious to keep up a brave show. "Come, let's have a drink, quick," said I. She nodded. We went into the nearest cafe and sat at an empty table by the window. "What'll you have, Pat?"
"Rum," said she,
and looked at me.
"Rum,"
I repeated, reaching for her hand under the table. She pressed it firmly in mine. The rum came. It was Bacardi with lemon.
"Old darling," said she, raising her glass.
"Good old lad," said I. We sat on a while.
"Queer sometimes, isn't it?"
said Pat.
"Yes.
Does come once in a while, but it passes again." She nodded. We went on, walking close side by side. Steaming sleigh horses trotted past us. Tired, sunburnt skiers. An ice hockey team in red and white sweaters, spitting life.
"How do you feel, Pat?"
I asked.
"Good, Robbie."
"If we could only become like that, eh?"
"Yes, darling."
She pressed my arm against her. The street emptied. The evening glow lay like a pink quilt on the snowy mountains. "Pat," said I, "I didn't tell you, we have stacks of money now. Custer sent some." She stopped.
"That's perfectly wonderful, Robbie. Then we'll be able to really go out for once."
"Why, sure," said I, "as often as we like."
"Then we'll go on Saturday to the Kursaal. The last big ball of the season is being held there then."
"But you aren't allowed out at night."
"Most of them aren't, but they go all the same."
I made a serious face.
"Robbie, all the time you weren't here, I did everything they told me. I was nothing but one anxious prescription, and it hasn't helped. I've only got worse. Don't interrupt me. I know what you're going to say. I know, too, what is involved." But the time I have still, this time with you, let me do as I will.
Her face was flushed in the descending sun. It was grave and still and full of an immense tenderness.
What are we saying?
Thought I with dry mouth. It's not possible we should be standing here discussing a thing that never can and never shall be.
And it's Pat who is saying these things.
Resigned, almost without regret, as if there was nothing to oppose it anymore. Not even the pitiful shreds of a deceitful hope, Pat of all people. Little more than a child still, whom it's my business to shield. Pat, suddenly gone far from me. Familiar already and reconciled with the nameless thing on the other side.
You mustn't say things like that,
I murmured at last.
I only thought, perhaps we ought to ask the doctor first. We're asking nobody anymore. Nobody.
She shook her lovely, frail head and looked at me with her dear eyes.
I don't want to know any more. I only want to be happy still.
In the evening, there was whispering and running to and fro in the corridors of the sanatorium. Antonio arrived with an invitation. There was to be a party in a Russian's rooms.
Can I go then, so simply? I asked.
Here?
Replied Pat.
You can do lots of things here you can't elsewhere, said Antonio, smiling.
The Russian was a dark, older man. He occupied two rooms spread with numerous carpets. On a chest stood schnapps bottles. The rooms were in semi-darkness, only candles burning. Among the guests was a beautiful young Spaniard. It was her birthday that was being celebrated. It was a peculiar atmosphere in these nickering rooms, reminiscent of a dugout, in their half-light and the curious fellowship of these people all united in a common destiny.
What will you drink? Asked the Russian. He had a warm, deep voice.
Whatever you have.
He brought a bottle of cognac and a carafe of vodka.
Are you well?
He asked.
Yes,
I replied, slightly embarrassed. He offered me cigarettes with long cardboard tips. We drank.
I suppose there's a lot here strikes you as rather strange, he observed.
Not so much, I replied. I'm not used to a specially normal life.
Yes, said he with a dark glance at the Spanish girl. It's a world to itself up here. It changes people.
I nodded.
A queer disease, he added thoughtfully.
It makes people more alive
and better sometimes, a mystic disease. It melts away the dross.
He rose, nodded to me, and went over to the Spanish girl, who smiled at him.
A heavy theatrical, eh? Asked someone behind me.
A face with no chin, a pimply forehead, restless, feverish eyes.
I'm his guest, said I. Aren't you?
He catches the women with it, though, persisted the other, unheeding.
He does catch them. The little one there, too.
I made no answer.
Who's that?
I asked Pat when he moved off.
A musician, violinist, hopelessly in love with the Spaniard. The way one does fall in love up here. But she won't look at him. She's in love with the Russian.
So should I be in her place.
Pat laughed. Seems to me that's a chap you might fall in love with, said I. Don't you agree?
No,
she replied.
Have you never been in love here?
Not very much.
It wouldn't make any difference to me, said I.
That's a nice confession.
Pat straightened.
Then it ought to make a difference to you.
I don't mean it that way.
I can't explain how I do mean it, and I can't explain because I still don't know what you can find in me.
Leave that to me, she replied.
Do you know then?
Not exactly, she replied with a smile. Else it wouldn't be love anymore.
The Russian had left the bottles. I poured myself a few glasses. The atmosphere in the room oppressed me. I did not like seeing Pat here among all these sick people.
Don't you like it here?
Not very much. I need to get used to it first.
My poor darling.
She stroked my hand. I'm not poor while you're here, said I.
Isn't Rita very beautiful?
No, said I. You are more beautiful. The young Spaniard had a guitar on her knees. She plucked a few chords. Then she began singing, and it was as if some dark bird hovered in the room. She sang Spanish songs in a muted voice, the hoarse, infirm voice of the sick. I don't know if it was the strange, melancholy songs, or the tremulous, twilight voice of the girl, or the shadows of the sick people cowering darkly in armchairs and on the floor, or the big, bowed, dark face of the Russian. But suddenly it came over me that all her song was only a sobbing, still exorcism of the fate standing outside beyond the curtained windows, waiting. A plea, a protest, and fear of being alone with the quietly devouring nothingness. The next morning, Pat was in high spirits. She busied herself with her dress.
It's got too wide, much too wide, she murmured, eyeing it in the looking glass. Then she turned to me. Did you bring a dinner suit with you, darling?
No, said I. Didn't know I'd have any use for one here.
Then go to Antonio. He'll lend you one. You are the same figure.
But he'll want it himself.
He's wearing tails.
She pinned a pleat.
And then go for a ski. I must get busy here, and I can't while you're about.
You're Antonio, said I. I'm robbing him properly. I wonder what we should do without him.
He is a good boy, isn't he?
Yes, I replied. That just describes him. Good boy.
I don't know what I should have done if it hadn't been for him all the time I was alone.
Don't let us think about that anymore, said I. It is so far back.
Yes.
She kissed me.
And now go and ski.
Antonio was already expecting me. I thought you would probably not have a dinner suit, said he. Just try on the coat. The coat was a bit tight, but it would do. Antonio whistled cheerfully and hung out the suit. It will be good fun tomorrow, he declared. Luckily, the little secretary is on night duty in the office. Old Rexroth wouldn't let us out. Officially, all that sort of thing is forbidden, but unofficially, we aren't children, of course. We went skiing. I had learnt quite well, and we did not use the nursery slope anymore. On the way, we encountered a chap with diamond rings, checked breeches, and a flowing artist's tie. Funny-looking things there are up here, said I. Antonio laughed. He's a very important chap, a corpse companion.
A what?
I asked in astonishment. A corpse companion, replied Antonio. You see, there are patients here from all over the world, especially from South America. Naturally, most families want to have their relations buried at home, so a corpse companion, like that chap, goes with it and sees the coffin home. Incidentally, they make quite a tidy sum and get around a lot. Death has made that one into a dandy, as you see. We climbed up a while longer, then put on our skis and ran down. The white slopes undulated up and down, and after us, barking, every now and then sinking to the chest in the snow, raced Billy like a red-brown ball. He had got used to me again, though he would still often turn in his tracks and race back hell for leather with flying ears to the sanatorium. I was practicing Christianius, and each time as I glided down the slope and prepared for the swing and relaxed my body, I would think,
If I do it this time without falling, Pat will get better. The wind whistled past my face. The snow was heavy and sticky, but I persisted. I sought out ever steeper descents, ever more difficult ground, and when it succeeded again and again, I thought saved, and knew it was foolish, and yet was happier than I had been for a long time. On Saturday evening, there was a big, secret exodus. Antonio had ordered sleighs to be ready a short distance below, and somewhat aside from the sanatorium. Himself, he tobogganed off, yodeling happily, down the slope in his dancing pumps and open coat, from under which gleamed the white waistcoat of his dress suit. "He's crazy," said I.
"He often does that," replied Pat. "He's quite irresponsible. It helps him, though. He wouldn't always be so good-humored otherwise."
"To make up, we're going to pack you in all the more." I wrapped her in every rug and shawl that we had. Then the sleighs tramped off down the hill. It was a long procession. Everybody who could had escaped. One might have thought we were a wedding party going down into the valley, so festively nodded the plumes on the horses' heads in the moonlight, and there was such laughter and shouting from sleigh to sleigh. The Kursaal was lavishly decorated. The dancing had already begun when we arrived. A corner, sheltered from drafts from the windows, was reserved for the guests from the sanatorium. It was warm and smelt of flowers, perfume, and wine. A crowd of people sat at our table. The Russian, Rita, the violinist, an old woman, a bejeweled death's head, a gigolo who belonged to it, Antonio, and some more.
"Come on, Robbie," said Pat. "Let's see if we can't dance."
The floor revolved slowly around us. The violin and cello rose in liquid melody above the whispering orchestra. Lightly, the feet of the dancers glided over the floor.
"But my dearest darling, you dance marvelously all of a sudden," said Pat in surprise.
"Well, hardly marvelously."
"But yes. Where did you learn?"
"Gottfried showed me," said I.
"In the workshop?"
"Yes, and the Café International. We had to have ladies, naturally. Rosa, Marion, and Vali put the finishing touches. But I'm afraid the result isn't exactly what would be called elegant."
"Oh, yes."
Her eyes were shining.
"The first time we've ever danced together, Robbie."
Alongside us, the Russian was dancing with the Spanish girl. He smiled and nodded to us. The Spaniard was very pale. Her black, glistening hair encircled her brow like the raven's wing. She danced with a fixed, solemn face. On her wrist was a bracelet of big, square emeralds. She was 18. From the table, the violinist followed her with lustful eyes. We went back again.
"Now I'd like a cigarette," said Pat.
"You oughtn't to, you know," I replied prudently.
"Only a few draws, Robbie. It's so long since I had a smoke."
She took the cigarette, but soon laid it aside.
"I don't like the taste, Robbie. I just don't like it anymore."
I laughed. "It's always so when you've been deprived of anything for a long time."
"You were deprived of me for a long time," said she.
"It's so only with poisons," I replied. "Schnapps and tobacco. Human beings are a much worse poison than schnapps or tobacco, darling." I laughed. "You are a clever child, Pat." She propped her arms on the table and looked at me.
"You have never taken me really seriously, have you?"
"I've never taken myself really seriously," I replied.
"Nor me. Be truthful for once."
"I don't know about that. But the two of us together, I've always taken terribly seriously. I do know that." She smiled. Antonio invited her to dance. The two walked to the dance floor. I watched while they danced. She smiled at me each time as she passed. Her silver shoes hardly touched the floor, she had the movements of an antelope. The Russian was dancing with the Spanish girl again. Both were silent. His big, dark face was filled with an overshadowing tenderness. The violinist had made an effort to dance with the Spaniard. She merely shook her head and walked to the dance floor with the Russian. The violinist broke a cigarette in his long, bony fingers. I suddenly felt sorry for him. I offered him a cigarette. He declined. I must take care of myself, he said in a jagged voice. I nodded. That chap, he went on with a snigger, pointing to the Russian, smokes 50 a day. One does one thing, another another, I replied. She may not want to dance with me now, but I'll get her yet. Who? Rita. He edged nearer. I was well in with her once. We used to play together. Then the Russian came and pinched her with his speechifyings. But I'll get her again. Then you'll have to overexert yourself, said I. I didn't like him. He broke into feeble laughter. Exert myself, you poor simp. I've only to wait. Then wait, by all means. 50 cigarettes, he whispered, daily. I saw his x-ray yesterday, cavity beside cavity. Finished. He laughed again. We were alike at the start. You might have interchanged the x-rays. You ought to see the difference now. I've put on 2 pounds. No, my boy, I've only to wait and take care of myself. I'm looking forward already to the next picture. The nurse always shows them to me. Wait, that's all. When he's out of the way, then will be my turn. One way, I suppose, said I. One way, he mimicked. The only way, you fathead. If I tried to cut across him now, I'd only spoil my chances for later. No, quite friendly, calmly, to wait. The air grew thick and heavy. Pat coughed. I noticed that she looked at me anxiously, so I pretended I had not heard. The old woman with the many pearls just sat quietly sunken in upon herself. Now and then she would give a shrill laugh. The death's head was quarreling with the gigolo. The Russian smoked one cigarette after another. The violinist lit them for him. A girl gave a sudden convulsive sob, held her handkerchief to her mouth, gazed into it, and turned pale. I looked along the room. Yonder were the tables of the winter sports people. There the tables of the solid burghers. There sat the French, there the English, and Dutchmen with the homely syllables of their speech, recalling meadows and the sea. And among them, this little colony of sickness and death. I looked at Pat. Meadows and sea, surf and sand and swimming. Ugh, thought I, dear frail brow. Dear hands, dear life, that I can only love and cannot save. I got up and went outside. I was stifled with oppression and impotence. I walked slowly along the path. I shivered with the cold, and the wind behind the houses made my flesh creep. I clenched my fists and stared at the hard white mountains in a wild mixture of helplessness, anger, and pain. A sleigh tinkled past on the road below. I went back. Pat was coming toward me.
Where have you been?
Only outside.
Are you vexed?
Not at all.
Be gay, darling. Be gay today. For my sake. Who knows when I'll be able to go to a ball again?
You'll go very often. She laid her head on my shoulder.
If you say so, it must be true. Come, let's dance again. We've never danced together before.
We danced, and the warm, soft light was merciful. It hid all the shadows that the late night had drawn on the faces. How do you feel, Pat? I asked.
Good, Robbie.
How lovely you are, Pat. Her eyes brightened.
It's lovely of you to say that to me.
I felt her warm, dry lips on my cheek. It was late when we got back to the sanatorium.
See now what he looks like? Sniggered the violinist, furtively pointing to the Russian.
You look just the same, said I irritably. He eyed me, startled.
Yes, of course, you health hog,
he muttered. I shook hands with the Russian. He nodded to me, and gently and lightly helped the Spanish girl up the stairs. As they climbed, his big, bowed back and the girl's frail shoulders against the feeble night lighting looked as if the burden of the whole world lay on them. The death's head dragged the sulking gigolo off down the passage. Antonio said goodnight to us. It was all rather ghostly, this almost soundless, whispered parting. Pat pulled her dress over her head. She stood bending over and tugged at the shoulders. As she did so, the stuff tore. Pat examined the place. It was probably split already, said I.
It doesn't matter, said Pat. I probably shan't ever use it again.
Slowly she folded up the dress and did not hang it again in the wardrobe. She laid it in her trunk. Her face was suddenly tired. Look what I've got here, said I quickly, and produced a bottle of champagne from my coat pocket. Now for our own little celebration. I brought glasses and filled them. She smiled again and drank.
To us both, Pat.
Yes, my darling. To our lovely life. How queer it all was.
This room, the stillness and our misery. And beyond the door, did not life stretch away unending, with forests, rivers, and strong breath? On the other side of the white mountains, was not March already knocking restless on the awakening earth?
Are you staying with me the night, Robbie?
Yes. Let's go to bed. Let's get as near together as human beings can, and put our glasses on the bed cover and drink. Drink. Golden brown skin. Waiting. Lying awake. Stillness. And the light wheezing of Pat's chest.